Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your
silence is commanded. Please be seated. Well, we have a full house on this beautiful day today. My notes tell me that the students from Monticello High School are here. If they are, will they please stand? Oh, very good. You may be seated. Well, the students are here on a program called Court with Class that we operate in conjunction with the state. So they know a little bit about the case that you're going to argue to us today. If you can remain after the second argument of the day, and this is the first one, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, who sits here on my left, will come down and chat with you, telling you a little bit about the Supreme Court, not talking about the merits of this case, but I'm sure she'll have things worth listening to, and anybody else that would like to join the discussion, of course, is welcome to do so as well. Now, before I call the first case, you will note that the chair on my right, where Justice Shirley Abrahamson often sits, is vacant. She has withdrawn from participation in this case, so we sit six. I now call State versus Trammell. Are you prepared to proceed? Please do.
Ursula Temska, appearing for Mr. Trammell. May it please the court. Mr. Trammell, as we argue here today, is serving a 20-year-long prison sentence for having been found guilty of armed robbery and another felony by jurors who were plainly and repeatedly told in the instructions defining the state's burden of proof and persuasion by the judge that the state needed to prove its prove guilt, innocence beyond reasonable doubt. But the same jurors were then also told by the same judge not to search for doubt, but to search for the truth. And the jurors were never told what beyond reasonable doubt meant. Never did they hear from the judge that beyond reasonable doubt required a certain level of certainty regarding the fact that the evidence presented to them satisfied them to near certainty that every element alleged was met. Therefore, the judge did not correctly instruct the jurors, and what to make things worse, both counsel in closing argument reinforced the message to the jurors that their job relied or depended on or consisted in searching for the truth. And therefore, Mr. Trammell is in prison today, having been found, we assert, factually guilty of armed robbery when the evidence elicited at trial showed that there was intent on his part to return the item he was accused of stealing, and that evidence came from the state's witnesses, from the victim, and then co-conspirator or co-actor, who was also a witness, and that evidence indicated that both the victim and Mr. Trammell were discussing or preparing to discuss plans for returning the item to the victim. Therefore, we assert the intent element was very highly disputed. In fact, defense counsel in closing just about admitted that all the other elements of taking and driving were met, and probably also all the other elements of armed robbery, but not the intent element.
The jury instruction were rewritten in accordance with the jury instruction committee's recommendation. Would that take care of the problem you present to us today?
Depends on how they were rewritten, and also depends on what Mr. Trammell's result would be from this court as a result of this.
Well, the committee recommends that the language be changed to You are to search for the truth and give the defendant the benefit of any reasonable doubt that remains after carefully considering all the evidence in the case.
Well, I'm not familiar with that recommendation, but I would say very clearly that if the truth language is recommended to be included anywhere near the definition of beyond reasonable doubt and anywhere near explain an explanation for the jurors on what their task is, then I would say that recommendation does not meet the requirement of due process.
Are you arguing that juries are not to find what really happened?
Yes. I am arguing that the jurors are to find whether, and specifically in only this question, the jurors are to find whether the evidence presented to them in the courtroom sufficiently satisfies them to a point of near certainty that every allegation is proven.
But the allegations are meant to figure out what actually happened, right?
The trial is this society's very highly structured and conventionalized way of resolving disputes about truth. And I think the Winship case explains that in pretty good detail, that it's the whole concept of a trial is based on a certain skepticism about the ability to determine truth reliably. That in every trial, there will be different accounts of the truth, and that the trial is the best way this society has come up with of resolving those disputes.
Right, but truth is kind of the shorthand we use for finding all of the elements beyond reasonable doubt. Aren't those two things equivalent? Truth is finding all the elements beyond reasonable doubt.
Yes, in legal parlance, that's what we are used to understanding the word truth to mean. When a juror hears the judge telling them, you are not to search for doubt, you are to search for the truth, we have no way of knowing what the juror understands that word to mean. If we go to the regular dictionary, it has three or four definitions that are part of the regular way the language functions, one of which concerns some transcendental big truth with a capital T. Another definition is a still different definition. So we don't really know when the jurors are told by a judge, go and search for the truth, what they are sent to do. And we don't know what standard they use. We know.
Sorry. As a follow-up to Justice Bradley's question, is it your position that you find that language that was proposed no better than the language that's currently used?
Well, as I said, I don't remember reading the recommendation that Justice Bradley read out to me.
It's in a footnote to the Jury Instruction Committee as an alternative language for it to be used after the committee considered this issue.
And I don't have that language in front of me, sadly. Thank you.
It did have the word truth in the same area that the words reasonable doubt were and are. And I think your answer to her was those two things can't be close together.
As the two courts that actually addressed this issue spoke clearly, the United States Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit and the Court of Appeals of Washington State in the two cases I cite and the amicus briefs cite, the word truth or the concept of truth would be error if used in a definition of beyond reasonable doubt or reasonable doubt. And it is not the juror's job. The truth is not the juror's job. It's exactly the language used by the court.
Yeah, where do you get that idea from?
I'm sorry?
Where do you get that idea from? The truth is not the juror's job.
I think we get this idea from all the foundational documents cited in Winship that I could itemize, but let me do it.
Are we really, are you asking us to say as a court that the object of a trial is not the search for truth?
The object of a trial may be the search of the truth, the best search of the truth this society has come up with. The job of a juror is not to search for the truth, especially not if truth is not defined to them as beyond reasonable doubt.
But the juror is the one, are the ones who are going to be giving the decision on what the truth is.
The jurors are the fact finders.
Yeah. So if the purpose of a trial is to find the truth, the jurors are the ones who do that, aren't they?
They may be, but if you tell them that they are to search for the truth and you don't explain to them what beyond reasonable doubt means and how to do that mandated, absolutely mandated, unquestionably unmandated work, then they will not know how to do their work.
So let me just push back a little bit. So is your position that our jury instruction on reasonable doubt does not define what reasonable doubt is?
It defines what reasonable doubt is. It does not define what beyond reasonable doubt is, and that is very clearly stated in the SPD amicus brief. And also, it misdirects the jurors because in giving them specific directions on how to perform their crucial job, it sends them on a path towards truth and not, and away from the path of doubt and reasonable doubt.
What about this provision in the jury instruction? It tells the jurors, if you can reconcile the evidence upon any reasonable hypothesis consistent with the defendant's innocence, you should do so, and return a verdict of not guilty.
It's probably accurate and it's acceptable in the definition of reasonable doubt, and we're not challenging the portion of the instruction that explains what reasonable doubt is to the jurors. What we are challenging is that the last 16 words added by what I had called the dual directives language in effect cancels, removes, overrides the definition of beyond reasonable doubt.
But doesn't the committee's, if we would accept the committee's recommendation, the last words the jury would hear is, give the defendant the benefit of any reasonable doubt that remains after carefully considering all the evidence in that case. I think opposing counsel provides you with a copy of it. I don't mean to keep reading it to you if you have it in front of you. But if that's the last thing the jury hears, would you still say that the jury has not been instructed properly?
I'm trying to look at the last two sentences or two words that you just asked me to opine about. And at this point, I'm not sure that I can answer your question, Justice Bradley.
So let's go back to the truth language. On page 33 of your brief, you say, as commanded, they presumptively searched for the truth to decide validly that the prosecution's robbery narrative was probably true. Why do you think they were only looking for what was probably true?
Because case law explains that the language of truth instills in the jurors' minds the understanding that they can, is an equivalent or near equivalent of the preponderance of evidence.
Why is that? We oftentimes refer to varying levels of certainty about what we believe the truth to be, right? And we say things like, I think proposition A is true. I think it's true. Or we might say, I'm pretty sure that proposition A is true. Or we might say, I'm dead on certain that proposition A is true, right? There are all levels of certainty by which we typically state what we believe to be true. Isn't that right?
Yes, that's right.
Okay. So why do you assume that when we say, when the jury instruction says you are to search for the truth, why do you assume that it is directing them to look for the lowest level of certainty of that truth?
Because this instruction doesn't address at all the level of certainty that jurors need to have.
Go ahead, Justice Kelly.
Everything that came before was talking about reasonable doubt, right?
Yes.
Aren't we to consider the command to search for truth in the context of being instructed to resolve the question beyond a reasonable doubt?
Yes, we are, but the jury instruction says, but which introduces the proviso section of the instruction as a whole, modifying the preceding sections of preceding language. The instruction says, but you are not to search for doubt, which is plainly, can be understood according to the dictionary definitions of the words, that the examination of doubt is not part of the juror's job. And then the instruction proceeds to say, you are to search for the truth, but you are not to search for doubt. Searching means examining, one of the key definitions, first definitions in the dictionary. That's the proviso section limiting the prior verbiage. And you are to search for truth, putting the jurors on a completely different path, misdirecting them away from examination for doubt and directing them towards examination of truth.
What kind of language would you include then as far as the establishment of beyond a reasonable doubt? I know there is definition in this instruction about what reasonable doubt is, but you're talking about the certainty level, and I don't know if you model that on other states and how they address it. I know moral certainty is not something we can talk about and we shouldn't be talking about pursuant to United States Supreme Court jurisprudence, but what exactly would you have the language read?
I would definitely remove the last 16 words. I would ask for a clear definition of the level of certainty the jurors need to have. And that is modeled to a pretty good degree by the Federal Judicial Center's Pattern Criminal Jury Instruction number 21 from 1987, which is cited in many cases, which reads as follows. May I?
Please.
The state has the burden of proving the defendant guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. In civil cases, it is only necessary to prove that a fact is more likely true than not, or that its truth is highly probable. In criminal cases such as this, the state's proof must be more powerful than that. It must be beyond reasonable doubt. Proof beyond reasonable doubt is proof that leaves you firmly convinced of the defendant's guilt. There are very few things in this world that we know this with absolute certainty. And in criminal cases, the law does not require proof that overcomes every doubt. If, based on your consideration of the evidence, you're firmly convinced that the defendant is guilty of the crime charged, you must find him or her not guilty. If, on the other hand, you think that there is a real possibility that he or she is not guilty, you must give him or her the benefit of the doubt and find him or her not guilty. That language has been apparently adopted by the Supreme or recommended to their jury committee as a model to work with in Arizona.
That sure sounds a lot like searching for the truth.
The word truth doesn't appear.
I know the word truth doesn't appear, but if you were to define truth, it would be defined pretty much by those sentences.
That may be true, Justice Ziegler.
You know, if I understand your argument, what you're saying is that truth is different from a reasonable doubt, and people could have reasonable doubt, but their doubt isn't grounded in the fact of what is true or what is not true. Correct? Truth is not, under your argument, truth is not really relevant. What's relevant is the level of certainty about the claims that were made, not whether they were true or not true.
Correct. And telling the jurors to look for the truth also on another dimension or on another level misdirects them because it tells them to look beyond the courtroom in making their determinations, which is because we know, as the definition cited recently by Judge Kelly, of truth is what happens out there in the real world, the actual world. So it's likely, and that some of the cases do mention that risk, the Berube case, for instance, that a juror told to look for the truth will be encouraged to look beyond the evidence and at facts out there in the real world in making their determination.
Boy, I think of how many times I've given these jury instructions, and it's a lot. And the jurors are instructed to rely on the evidence in the case, not something outside the courtroom. So how can you make that stretch that they're now also at jury instruction by this. We have to presume that they're following the instructions.
And we have to presume that they're following the instruction to follow the truth, to search for the truth. There is the contradiction there. And if truth means something that happens outside of the courtroom, out in the real world.
They're instructed to rely on the evidence presented. They're even told that the arguments of the lawyers is not evidence. And they're to base their decisions solely on the evidence at trial. So to assume that based upon a search for the truth, they're going to disregard the evidence of the case and the instruction that a reasonable doubt, the jury instruction regarding reasonable doubt, a reasonable doubt is a doubt that would cause a person of ordinary prudence to pause or hesitate when called upon to act in the most important affairs of life. They're told that. It's a doubt for which a reason can be given.
Mm-hmm.
And it's based upon the evidence in that case. So now you're also saying that they're disregarding that other part of 140 because the word truth is in there.
Because they are not able to follow all the instructions given when they are contradictory. If on the one hand they are told beyond reasonable doubt is this and that, and on the other hand they are said, but do not search for doubt, search for the truth, they cannot do both at the same time and are presumed to, under the law, follow the instructions. There may be the first part that you just cited, or it may be the truth part, which is the last thing they hear, which, as we know from all the sciences, communication studies, psychology, marketing, that is the part that they will stay with them, that they will take with them, that will be applied.
Counsel, if you prevail, I have concerns about retroactivity. Could you try to convince me that my concerns are unfounded?
The state asserts that every criminal conviction since 1962 is a balance, or might be. I don't see the floodgates as opening that wide. First of all, as to cases on direct appeal, we know how few percentage-wise result from trial convictions. We would only be talking about cases where there had been a trial and where that language was given. And that language is not given in every case because we know that judges have discretion and occasionally they will modify the instruction when asked. So,
but is it your position that in every case that proceeded to conviction that used this language, it would then be subject to review?
If it's on direct appeal and it's still pending appeal, that would be the call for the attorney, for the appellate attorney to make, or if it's preserved.
And what about cases that have gone outside the pipeline, but still potentially motions could be brought, or perhaps writs, maybe a habeas corpus, based on a structural error, right?
Well, I understand the concern, and clearly, I'm sure we are all on the same one team in terms of upholding the fundamental principles of due process, and sadly, if that's what were to be ruled, if this were structural error, then potentially yes. But
convince me that I should have no worries. So continue with that, if you would, please.
Well, I did not brief the issue. I am Mr. Trammell's attorney, and it's certainly I'm not competent to solve this problems this kind of institutional problem. But even, and my light is on, so my yellow light is on, even on collateral review, it will still only concern cases where the trial happened, where this verbatim instruction was given, only if they're still in custody, which will limit the number of the possible appellants. And then whether it's retroactive or not retroactive, case law, based on a relatively cursory review, goes both ways.
Mm-hmm. It does. Yeah.
And, for instance, Cage and a decision from from a Massachusetts court in 2003 called Gaines v. Matesans, MATESANZ, indicates that, yes, it would be applied retroactively, but There is other case law from SCOTUS, from the United States Supreme Court, namely Tyler v. Kane, 533 U.S. 656, 2001 case, which indicates that even if it's an instructional error that might be structural is found, it does not automatically mean that the case finding that error would apply retroactively.
Is there also an issue that you have in this case as well, where you didn't, where the attorney did not make the specific objection to this instruction? I mean, you said it had to be preserved. Is this, in this case, is it even preserved?
Well, clearly, as that's one of the arguments I make, is that the attorney had no idea, could not have known.
Well, could not have known because there's two new studies, but no. Isn't this been a problem potentially? If your argument's correct, then this has been a problem since 1962. And why would two studies that only address a few small groups of people really be the impetus for making that objection? Shouldn't that objection have been made anyway?
Well, the objection was overruled and rejected by this court in 1995 in the Avila case, and any reasonable attorney familiar with the ruling precedent would assume that is correct law. I don't see duty on his part to challenge this, and therefore raising that instruction would be either frivolous or at least a dead end. So I see no reason for him to raise that objection. The studies, by the way, are just the tangible, quantifiable evidence of something that everybody has known. It's a big elephant in the room for a long time, as the amicus not the public defender, the other amicus indicates. This is something we've all known, even definitely cites to a blog from Justice Bauer, who himself had been a prosecutor, who says, we've known it, I've used it, we all in the profession know that the burden is lowered, diluted, when the word truth or when the truth language is introduced into the courtroom. My time is up.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Tiffany Winter and I represent the state of Wisconsin. I'd like to begin by addressing some of the concerns that the court expressed during questioning of my opponent. Trials are a search for truth. Verdict derives from verdictum, which means a declaration of truth. The Supreme Court noted in Brown versus United States that the functions of the courts of justice is to ascertain the truth. The Seventh Circuit noted in United States versus Harper that calling a trial a search for truth is simply an uncontroversial position.
Let me controvert it. In this way, I guess, as set forth in the public defender amicus brief, in discussing truth, it speaks of theologians and philosophers and scientists, and it explicates on the development of beyond a reasonable doubt and how we got there. But in reality, first of all, if you want something that's true, let me tell you, the phrase, let the verdict speak the truth, let whatever the truth may be, it is true that judges love saying that. And judges love saying, you are not this, you know, but you are to search for the truth. I mean, that gives us a high moral plane, right? So that's true, number one. But, you see, I think trials are really based on coming in with a presumption of innocence, and is the state able to prove beyond a reasonable doubt the guilt? I mean, I guess that's so. I know it sounds nice and it makes us feel good because we're taking the moral high road, but in reality, sometimes the state can prove it regardless of the truth. Sometimes they can't, regardless of the truth. And our system is the state has the burden to prove it. That's the way I see it in reality.
And that's accurately reflected in our burden of proof instruction. The jury in this case was reminded that the defendant has the presumption of innocence, and that that presumption cannot be overcome unless the evidence satisfies them beyond a reasonable doubt that he is guilty.
And then the instruction goes on to define what reasonable doubt is. But that isn't the total quarrel of your opposing counsel. The reasonable doubt definition doesn't address the level of certainty. That is what the burden is. And, of course, we heard and see in the briefs some suggestions like the state of mind is near certainty, or the highest degree of certainty achievable. Those kinds to describe what the burden is when we say beyond a reasonable doubt. That's what's missing, they're saying.
I disagree. I don't think that our instruction does not define beyond a reasonable doubt. By defining what a reasonable doubt is, it necessarily defines what beyond a reasonable doubt is.
And so, and what's the burden? Clear, satisfactory, and convincing isn't the burden, right? And what does beyond a reasonable doubt, beyond a reasonable doubt mean? What level of certainty do you need?
I think it was reflected in the passage that was read by Justice Ziegler. Beyond a reasonable doubt means that somebody who has, in their ordinary affairs, would have a hesitation to act, meaning that you're not certain, you're hesitant. That is defined within our instruction. And when the instruction is viewed as a whole, which is what we are required to do here, look at the entire instruction, not bits and pieces, I believe it is beyond clear. The state's burden is to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. The jury is told that the defendant is presumed to be innocent. They are told what a reasonable doubt is, and they are told that they are to give the defendant every benefit of any reasonable doubt. It is not that we're looking at a simple passage at the end, the last 16 words. We are looking at the entire instruction, and the entire instruction is clear, as this court decided in State versus Avila.
Counsel, Mr. Trammell's counsel says at page 13 of her brief, the two studies stand unrefuted. Both studies are reliable science on which this court should rely in reviewing and reversing Avila. Are the two studies reliable science?
No.
Why not?
The studies are unreliable because they set out with a goal in mind. So these studies were conducted and commissioned by a prominent defense attorney for the purpose of proving that this language impermissibly lowers the state's burden of proof.
But scientists often do that, right? They've got a goal they want to reach, and they set out their hypothesis, and then they do their experimentation, right?
Even if you assume that every scientist has some sort of bias in the beginning, the studies here are not reliable in the way that they were conducted. They took a sample from an online marketplace. So these participants were self-identified. They selected to do this. They were not screened for any particular bias regarding the fact pattern that was provided to them. The fact pattern that was provided was simply a synopsis. They were not placed into deliberations. They were not told they had to come to a unanimous verdict.
How important are those two things? The fact that they did not deliberate as a group and that they were not required to come to a verdict. How important is that?
Very important.
Why?
Because that's exactly what we ask a jury to do. When we send a jury back to decide a case, we don't say, each of you, go back, come out with your individual answers, and let us know what those are. We tell them they must go back, they must deliberate, and they must be unanimous. That process of talking out the differences, discussing the evidence, is what ensures reliability in our verdict.
All right, and that's a very good argument, and I agree that looking at these studies, just the process doesn't appear to be exactly what we do. Mm-hmm. But you've got two studies that, when given this instruction, are reaching the same conclusion as they would have had they not been had they only been told in the first one about truth. I mean, you've got more than one fact pattern, so they repeated the study. even though you're not putting them through the process, the results of it do indicate somehow that potentially this language of truth might play into people's decision-making. I mean, shouldn't we give thought to that, even if it's not the most persuasive study, or there's only two, or the way they conducted it wasn't exactly the way we conduct jury trials? I mean, the results are still there. So how do you propose we address that?
The results of the study, I don't believe, actually show that the search for truth language does what they purport it to do. So they put a lot of emphasis on a particular question that was asked to the participants afterwards, whether if they had doubt if in their search for truth, could they still find the defendant guilty?
Well, that's the second study only. The first study just gave the language, just gave them an instruction and asked them to make a conclusion.
That's true. But we don't know what the participants did. We don't know anything about them. They weren't in the room. We don't know what they considered. We don't know how they deliberated. We don't even know if they read the fact.
Okay, we don't know that anyway. I mean, after all the jury trials, all the people, and if you want to say screen them, I mean, some of these voir dire are 10 minutes. Sometimes juror never answers a question. They just get picked. So, I mean, I get what you're saying, and I agree that from a scientific perspective, we're just talking about two studies that aren't exactly the way we do things, but what kind of consideration should we give this in the future? If the presumption of innocence and beyond a reasonable doubt really means something in our system, is it prudent for the jury instructions committee to take a look again at the arguments that are being made here and potentially revise the instruction? Who does that hurt?
It doesn't hurt for the jury instruction committee to take a look at it. The jury instructions, the pattern instructions in Wisconsin are simply that. They're a pattern. The judge has full discretion to change the pattern instruction. The patterns are just a suggestion. So if the jury instruction committee wants to take a look at it again, they are free to do that, obviously.
It looks like they already have. Does the state have a problem with the alternative formulation proposed by the committee at the end of the comment to the jury instruction?
I actually don't read it as an alternative. I read it as if in addition to the text is desired that they would add that additional language. So I don't believe the jury instruction committee actually proposed an alternative. They proposed an additional text in addition to the you are not to search for doubt, you are to search for the truth language.
Does the state have a problem with that addition?
We do not. I think it accurately defines the burden of proof, again, that the jury is to search for truth and to give the defendant every benefit of a reasonable doubt. So I don't believe it actually adds anything, but I don't find it problematic at all.
Does the state have a problem with more definitions surrounding what it means to be beyond a reasonable doubt as opposed to just the definition of reasonable doubt, which appears in the instruction?
I think defining beyond a reasonable doubt and the level of certainty that is required for a jury to convict is problematic. That was the issue in the Cage and Sullivan decisions, where they were trying to put a quantifier on what reasonable doubt was, what grave was too big, and what their burden and as far as moral certainty. So when we start to quantify in terms of levels of what your doubt must be beyond a reasonable doubt, that's where the courts have found that there is problems.
Well, but if we can't define it for the jury, how are they supposed to know what it is?
But we do define it for a jury. We define what a reasonable doubt is, and then we tell them that your decision must be beyond a reasonable doubt. So by defining reasonable doubt without quantifying beyond, we are necessarily giving the jury the proper instruction. If you have a reasonable doubt, you must convict him or acquit him. If you have an unreasonable doubt, meaning the jury doesn't have a license to speculate here, this is an important part of the instruction. You are not to search for doubt. You are to search for the truth. The jury does not have a license to speculate. Their doubt must be reasonable. And we define what a reasonable doubt is. So if they are convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that he is guilty, then they can convict him. If they are not, they must acquit. And that is entirely clear from Wisconsin's instruction and the instruction given in this case.
Counsel, I want to make sure I'm not ignoring any valid science. I do have one question for you on the two studies. What role does peer review play in scientific studies?
important role. It's one of the most important roles in scientific studies. These studies were published in law review articles, which necessarily means they went through no peer review. There was no peer review requirement before they were published. They also have not been picked up by anybody beyond the author of this particular study, so they haven't been picked up by others within the legal community or within the social science community, from my understanding. So there has been no peer review. And more importantly, I think as the state identified in their brief, this court is asked to resolve a question of law. It is not asked to resolve a question of fact or even a mixed question of law or fact. We are presented with a question of law here. And as this court recently decided in State versus PICO, outside information does not inform that decision. Social science research should not inform what the law is. This court decides what the law is. And we, the state, asks that this court, consistent with that recent decision, hold that in this case as well. I would also like to address now briefly the question of Justice Bradley about retroactivity. So after Cage was decided by the United States Supreme Court, there was a subsequent decision in Sullivan which found that an error in the burden of proof instruction was structural error and not subject to the harmless error analysis. After that, an individual on habeas came with a request on collateral review to have Cage applied retroactively to him so that he could obtain relief. The United States Supreme Court refused to decide the issue of whether Cage should have been retroactive because of the procedural posture of the case. Nothing else besides that it was in a habeas posture, he was in a subsequent petition, and they decided they did not have to reach that issue. The dissent there talks at length that Cage should be retroactive, and the court did identify in the retroactivity analysis where courts should look to whether a burden of proof instruction applies on collateral, or a change to a burden of proof instruction can be a challenge on collateral review. And they look to the second exception in Teague, which is the watershed rules of criminal procedure. So the U.S. Supreme Court has identified the retroactivity analysis that this court would conduct if it wants to go there, if it decides that the burden of proof instruction isn't an accurate statement of law. You can find guidance for that in the Cain decision. I would also like to address that Trammell did forfeit his review of this challenge.
Do you think it's correct? A correct response to me is, but Justice Bradley, you should search for the truth in the law, whatever the truth may be, regardless of the consequences, regardless of whether it is retroactive, regardless of whether or not it's going to cause, as suggested, chaos, that if there are constitutional rights that are being violated, if that's the truth, that's the answer. How do you respond to that?
You're absolutely correct. We don't consider the impact of the decision, whether it's retroactive and how many convictions would be at risk, in determining what the law is. Mm-hmm. Like I said before, the law is the law. This court declares what it is, and then it will decide whether it will be sunburst or applied retroactively. Mm-hmm. That's why I didn't spend a lot of time on the retroactivity analysis, because it should not inform the court's decision of whether the instruction accurately states the law. Going back to Trammell's forfeiture of this challenge, Trammell contends that he should not have been required to object at the time of the jury instruction conference because the ground for the objection was not known. But as Justice Dallet pointed out, the ground for this objection has been well known for nearly a century.
And as the response was, though, it's been known, but we have case law that eliminated it as a realistic objection, which is the Avila case. So should defense counsel still have made the objection knowing that the answer by the court is this has already been decided by the Supreme Court?
Yes, he should have. As my opponent actually stated during oral argument, not every conviction where the burden of proof instruction was read will actually be implicated by this court's decision because objections have been raised and judges have modified the instruction. Again, in Wisconsin, we have pattern instructions, and the circuit courts have wide discretion to modify the instruction so long as it accurately sets forth the law. If Trammell would have raised the objection, This court's precedent would likely inform the circuit court's decision on whether to modify the instruction, but it would not require the court to overrule his objection and to not modify the instruction. So he should have made the objection at the time of the instructional conference, and because he did not, he forfeited direct review of that. And I think it's very important for this court to reaffirm that principle that was announced in Schumacher, that 805.13 sub 3 does apply in this situation. This case is also distinguishable from the case that was relied on by my opponent in briefing, which is the Howard case. It's a very different set of circumstances where the court actually interpreted a statute, concluded that there was additional elements necessary to improve the dangerous weapon enhancer, and then concluded that the instruction in that case was inaccurate, and there was no possible way for the defendant to know that he should have objected. It's very different here. The objection should have been well known at the time of the conference. So again, going back to the instruction itself, when this court reviews a jury instruction, we look at the instruction as a whole. There is nothing that has changed in the burden of proof instruction since the Avila decision in 1995. The instruction accurately set forth the law then, and it does so now. Trammell has not pointed to anything to question the jury instruction's validity beyond the social science studies. And as I stated before, these studies should not inform a question of law. The studies are not inherently reliable in this issue because the jurors were not required to deliberate. They were not presented with evidence as it is presented at trial. They simply were presented with a summary, and we have no idea of knowing what those mock jurors did with it. Because the social science research should not inform the question of law and is not reliable here, this court should reaffirm Avila. If there's any other questions from the court? Thank you.
Thank you.
In a brief rebuttal, I will say the following. Mr. Trammell is asking this court to thoroughly examine this prime instrument this legal system has developed for determining the guilt or non-guilt of a defendant, as this court did in a civil case challenging a jury instruction in a civil suit.
Counsel, I'm a little concerned about reviewing something so fundamental and foundational based on two law review articles.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, the two law review articles are records of scientifically, essentially unrefuted studies.
Let me just push back against that for a second. Your opposing counsel indicated that peer review was an of the scientific method. And these have not been peer-reviewed, have they?
The second article was subject to peer review.
That was peer review for a law review publication, not a scientific publication.
Peer review is a process in the publication, is a step in the publication process. It's a step in which scientists and publishers determine whether to publish or not publish an article based on it's substantive science, including, by the way,
but in this case, only by certain journals. I mean, in the scientific community, many journals publish many articles.
Correct.
These were not published in any scientific journal, but
correct,
only certain journals do peer review. And it's a big feather in the cap of a scientist to have something published in a peer review. If it's published elsewhere, it's not taken much account of, frankly.
That's correct, Justice Rockenstein.
Right, in this case, the peer review happened in a law review, and that was just, would this be an interesting article to publish, right? It didn't analyze the merits.
It may have, I'm not sure. I don't remember rereading the peer review policy that journal relies on. One of the criteria for deciding whether to publish peer review is what the p-value of the scientific results are, which in a scientific journal, by the way.
Are you suggesting that the law review was, in deciding whether to publish this, doing a scientific analysis of its findings?
It may have. I'm not sure. I don't remember the details.
Ooh, I've
of
been
the
on
process.
Law review, and I don't think that's what they do at all.
Well, the policy is entirely stated in a footnote in my brief, and perhaps you're very right, Justice Ziegler and Justice Kelly. I'm not sure they reviewed the substantive scientific merits of the studies.
How do you respond to the argument made by the state that Mr. Trammell should have still objected, even though Avila was good law, because circuit courts can and do have the ability to modify what are just pattern instructions, and that he could have, potentially this court would have changed that sentence or taken out that sentence or even applied the modification suggested by the jury instruction committee?
Well, I guess if defense counsel were hyper aware of the possibility of that issue coming up in the future, he might have. I don't think most of the reasonable counsel, would object in light of the primacy and the controlling status of the Avila decision and the misconception that's clear from the record of believing and telling the jurors that what they are doing is searching for the truth. In this case, defense counsel even said this repeatedly in his closing argument. There is nothing more important today for you than to decide the truth of this case. It's a popular misconception. It's held by reasonable attorneys, and it's very reasonable for counsel, I think, to not challenge that jury instruction under the circumstances. Another important thing regarding the critiques of the studies that one of your justices raised was there were no deliberations in this case. And my response is that look at the Victor test. The test is very specific and very clear and very narrow. Is there a reasonable likelihood that jurors misunderstood the instruction as indicating that they could convict on a standard lower than Winship's? It's a linguistic, cognitive, subjective situation of what happens between the language of the instruction and an individual juror. There's no room for deliberations in that process. And the studies, if you may disagree, were correctly designed to measure the result of this one variable, one isolated variable being pretty much the last 16 words of that jury instruction. If the studies were correctly designed to do that, then all the considerations of deliberations and others are immaterial. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you both for very interesting arguments. The court is going to take a brief recess now so that some students can leave and others can come in, and another panel of attorneys can be set up. So we are adjourned.